The migrant caravan from Honduras and Guatemala has made its way into Mexico, and a few thousand people remain as it pushes onward to the southern border of the U.S. Rhetoric against the caravan has been frequently used by President Trump, and online comments in that vein were also attributed to the Pittsburgh synagogue shooter. That attack and anti-immigrant sentiment have led Evalley Group, the Phoenix Restoration Project, to ask members of the media to, quote, not use the names or faces of refugees receiving assistance in Phoenix and to refrain from using the names and locations of the churches and nonprofits that help, end quote. To learn more, I'm joined by Leah Surratt, core volunteer member of the Phoenix Restoration Project. So, Leah, why did you and the organization make this request of the media?
What prompted this was we were concerned about the recent anti-Semitic act of terror that was taken against the Jewish synagogue. And we already know that Robert Bowers, the alleged shooter now in custody, believed that Jewish people were helping transport members of the so-called caravan of refugees fleeing violence and hunger in Honduras. That it's safe to assume after checking his social media posts that this belief was the final motivator for his attack. So we just felt that this is a time of heightened tension and concern. There are a lot of fears in the United States about the migrant caravan. It's being used to flame anti-immigrant sentiment. And we felt that this was just a time to get out the message about utmost care being needed for the anonymity and safety of those that we're working with.
In the release, it says there are a small number of churches, medical professionals, and volunteers who assist those released by ICE here in the Phoenix area. Can you give me an idea of how many people or for whom Phoenix Restoration Project is speaking with this release?
Our organization is not the only one on the scene at the moment. We have been over the past few years. We have been primarily the organization that has facilitated care for people at churches and other humanitarian organizations. But as of the last couple of weeks, as things have gotten a bit more busy here in Phoenix, there have been a number of churches involved. We've partnered with, say, about four or five organizations, and the rest, I believe, have been contacted by ICE separately. A couple of weeks ago, we assisted with providing support for about 120 families who came through the Phoenix area.
What sort of expectations would you have for media in terms of how they would cover something like this? Is this just sort of give an extra thought before you report on something, or is it deeper than that?
Well, I think, and this goes beyond the immediate circumstances we're facing right now in the United States, but through the course of the last few years, we've seen that many of those we assist are fleeing violence in Central America. I've had more than one person tell me I absolutely cannot have my photo appear in the news or in any other source because there are people back home who want me dead. So what we try to do is, as a volunteer organization, our primary concern is that people safely get on their way and that their immediate needs are being taken care of. What I've mentioned to the news media, it's not a secret that people pass through the Greyhound station. Most people are traveling on buses. And my advice would be to not approach an individual, but just always consider the power dynamics at play. Perhaps reach out to a larger group of people traveling, state your purpose and that you're there, and then see who comes forward. Sometimes people do come forward and they do want to share their stories. But what we find as volunteers, when we have people in an environment that we've arranged to support them, provide them with food, with phone assistance, water, other practical assistance, asking people for interviews compromises the clarity of our vision and our mission to help, because we find that people feel as though they do not have the option to say no, they feel indebted to us. So it's always considering that power dynamic at play, and that this may not be the best moment in people's lives where they would like to sit down and tell a story. We also like to talk about how trauma, we should not be asking about trauma, asking people to unpack stories that they're not prepared to put back away. And we feel sometimes in the pressure of the moment, they may feel as though they're obligated to tell a story that might not be in their best interest to tell.
Have you been concerned that some media have handled it that way from the standpoint that there is that balancing act of trying to give people more information, and maybe people may not have known of some of the plight of many of these refugees, obviously without the media, but there's a concern on your part that you've mentioned the power dynamics. Is that at the core of this?
There's a great deal of difference between, you know, assisting people and explaining to them that they may encounter media later on in their journeys and advising them about their options versus directly collaborating with the media and allowing a news resource to film people the moment they step off an ICE bus, right? So I think it's very concerning when entire groups of people are getting filmed without their explicit consent. And I have seen some reporters who are much more aware of the power dynamics. They might sit back and observe a situation in more of a public location, and they might approach an entire group and ask if anyone would like to share their story, and then kind of sit back instead of persisting and waiting for them to come forward.
There have been, of course, in the past, at the national level, there have been concerns that maybe the New York Times shouldn't report something because it could put people in national security danger. And for some people, that was also sort of a potential chilling effect on that. Do you worry about the message it sends that, okay, media, up to a point we like this, but not beyond that?
You know, I really struggle on this. I think it is important for some stories to get out in a tactful manner. But I believe that right now, those who are concerned about the plight of those in the migrant caravan, for example, those who are concerned are already out on the ground, are already reaching out in their personal networks, in their communities, in their churches, asking, how can I help? So I think the need to sway national attention right now has to happen more through word of mouth, more through people's personal connections, because I believe that those who have a strong anti-immigrant sentiment right now, their minds are already made up, and they're going to not use these sorts of stories in the best way.
That is Leah Surratt, core volunteer member of the Phoenix Restoration Project, which has asked the media to refrain from using the names or showing the faces of its volunteers or the refugees they're helping.
So what is the role of media in protecting the vulnerable people it reports on? For more on that question, we are joined by Helen Benedict, a professor in Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, who specializes in the effects of war on civilians and has recently covered the refugee crisis in Greece. So Helen, it seems like there's a balance there that media has to strike between reporting on these kinds of issues and also protecting the identities of some of the refugees involved.
Exactly. It is all about balance. I believe that our very first obligation is not to put our sources in danger. So just as we have various rules about reporting on sexual assault survivors, so do we have or should have rules around reporting on refugees or anyone else or the undocumented, anyone else who could be put in danger by naming them. So it's very common, in fact, to report on refugees and only use their first names, sometimes if they're identifiable by where they come from, a particular village or something. We also very often don't mention that or explain, even better, to just explain to the reader or the listener or the viewer why we can't name and identify these people. So it becomes part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
I don't actually think it is as important for readers to know the full name of a source, and because most of us don't know these people. And the point is their stories and their predicament, not their names. So I don't think it's a huge compromise for us to put their safety first.
Yeah. Do you think this extends to the people who work with refugees and that community right now?
Well, I think that's a little more difficult because if you think about the request in that letter, you know, that we also keep the workers, the volunteers anonymous, it is hard to talk about a volunteer organization and never name it. So perhaps we don't have to name the workers actually individually, but not naming the organization, I think, is more difficult. I'm totally sympathetic with needing to keep safe. But I think we also need to bear in mind that we can't let ourselves be so intimidated by these fanatics who want to shoot us up that we start to hide all our work and hide away in a way that's letting them win. And I realize that's easy for me to say when I'm not in the position of being afraid of being shot. But nonetheless, there is a point. We have to draw a line about how intimidated we're going to allow ourselves to be.
Are you seeing requests like this, like the one we have here from the Phoenix Restoration Project around the country, especially in light of the anti-immigrant rhetoric in the country right now?
I've never seen it put in a letter so formally and sweepingly as that one, but I've been asked verbally all the time to please not name this person or that person. For example, to go back to the camps in Greece, and I'm sure that there are equivalents here, the volunteer organizations are very often working with the refugees under the auspices of the government's organization. So, for example, here, if you wanted to go in as a volunteer to an ICE detention center so that you could help some of the immigrants who are being held there, if you start to badmouth the detention center, they could just block your way and not let you go in and do your work anymore. So very often those volunteers will say, you know, please don't quote us at all on what's going on inside. You can only use us for background information. Otherwise, we won't be able to do our work.
Right. But does that sort of impede the story? Not in the sense that, like, we as journalists want to tell the story, but in the sense that these are important stories to tell and that the public know about.
Yes. So it means a challenge for reporters. So, okay, a volunteer says, look, I went, and this is hypothetical, but I went into this ICE detention and I saw that the children there are actually starving, say. But you can't quote me on that. So then what the reporter has to do is verify it on her own. She has to find other ways of maybe people who, the parents who are visiting or people who come out of that camp who could say, yes, my kid got malnutrition while we were there. You know, you have to be very inventive as a reporter and, you know, enterprising and figure out other ways of verifying information if you can't get it from the volunteers. But you can't quote somebody who's asked not to be quoted. That's really an ethical violation. You could really hurt people if you do, not to mention the reputation of journalists in general.
Yeah. All right. Helen Benedict is a professor at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. Helen, thank you so much for coming on the show this morning.
Thank you.